Our final speaker of the session is Jim Kestings on habitability and evolution of Earth's atmosphere and climate. We have late breaking announcement here.
Yeah, so thank you to the organizers for inviting me to speak, and my apologies to the organizers, especially Kristen, for changing the talk title. The title that you have is something to do with habitability and 3D models. As I mentioned in my comment earlier, I actually did have a student who finished 2 years ago now, Adam Edson, who did a thesis on circulation of Earth, on Earth-like planets going around that are tidally locked and going around M stars. It's very idealized. He did dry planets and he did water planets and he did different rotation rates. And there's one interesting result, which to me, which is that there's a big dynamical transition somewhere between 4 and 5 day rotation rate where you can no longer wrap a Rossby wave around the planet. But the rest of it, I think, is pretty dry. I'm not really a dynamicist, so I thought it would really be more interesting to talk in more general terms to this audience about planetary habitability. And then I really liked something that Dave Stevenson said philosophically earlier. Dave emphasized that, you know, we really know a lot, relatively a lot, about the planets in our own solar system. And Dave talked about the giant planets. For Earth-like planets, there's one planet that we know a lot about, and that's the Earth. And so what I plan to talk about, with your permission, is to talk about the Earth today and the evolution of the Earth's climate in particular. There's some new stuff on that, and so that's actually more interesting than just redoing the habitable zone, which is not new at this point. So I should warn you that there are two ads in this talk. The first one is that there is a new group called the ExoPag, which many of you have probably heard of. It's the Exoplanet Program Analysis Group, which just got started. We had our first meeting at the January AAAS meeting, and there were lots of people in the room, so this is good. If you are familiar with the planetary science program, there are PAGs in planetary science. There's MEPAG for Mars and OPAG for the outer planets. ExoPag is the same type of thing for exoplanets. And there will be a meeting, our next meeting is going to be June 24th to 25th in Pasadena at a venue that not yet been chosen. But I just wanted to mention that because it's a place to discuss possible strategies. It's not really an advice group. We're, you know, very careful to say we're not providing advice to NASA, but we're going to analyze problems. And so if you have a problem that you want to bring to the exoplanet community attention, these meetings are open to everybody, and that's a good place to do it. Now, the way I wanted to motivate my talk today is to talk about books. You know, the Earth is a habitable planet, and there are different theories for why the Earth is habitable. One theory is what's called the Gaia hypothesis. It's been pushed by Jim Lovelock and his sometimes co-conspirator Lynn Margulis, who's a biologist in the United States. Lovelock has written 5 or 6 books about Gaia. Gaia is the Greek goddess of Mother Earth, and the thesis of the Gaia books is that life itself determines the habitability of the Earth, so that if you didn't have life, Earth would not be habitable. Now, many of us don't really believe that, but there's some interesting ideas there, and he writes very well. His most recent book, I should say, which I haven't read, is called The Revenge of Gaia. So Lovelock is getting to where he's worried about global warming, and now Gaia is taking revenge on us for not taking good care of the planet. There's another author, Peter Ward, and his sometimes co-author Don Brownlee. Peter is a paleontologist at University of Washington, and Don Brownlee, many of you probably know, is a well-known astronomer at UWashington. Peter's most recent book is The Medea Hypothesis, which is the opposite of the Gaia Hypothesis. The Medea Hypothesis is the idea that life destabilizes the Earth's climate, and Peter wrote it specifically in response to Gaia because he doesn't like the Gaia Hypothesis. More relevant to the talk today is a previous book by Peter Ward and Don Brownlee called Rare Earth, which some of you may be familiar with. This book is 10 years old now. But this book really caught my attention. It's sold a lot of copies, by the way. It's sort of the anti-Carl Sagan book. Carl Sagan was an optimist on habitable planets. Ward and Brownlee are pessimists on habitable planets. And their thesis is that Earth-like planets are rare. Complex life, meaning animal life, and of course including humans, is really rare in the universe. And they have a variety of arguments, which I'm not going to go through all of them, but they're summarized in the book. One of them has to do with plate tectonics, which came up earlier. And so they point out in the book that there are 20 solid bodies in the solar system, terrestrial planets and large moons. And of those, Earth is the only planet that has plate tectonics. Therefore, plate tectonics is rare. So we already heard enough, I think, from Deanna's talk to know that the question is actually more complicated than that. Maybe Ward and Brownlee are right, but that's sort of, from my perspective, the level of argument in at least parts of their book. Now here's the other ad that's in the talk, and that's an ad for a virus that has crept into my computer. So the other ad is that I have a new book that just came out in January, How to Find a Habitable Planet. The title is a ripoff of a title by Wally Broker, who's a very well-known geochemist at Lamont Doherty. He wrote a book 25 years ago called How to Build a Habitable Planet. And so my book is, it's about TPF. It works up to what Lisa was just talking about. But actually, a third of it is about the Earth, and then the second third is about Earth, Venus, Mars. And so, I try to talk about some of these issues as to why the Earth is habitable and why Venus and Mars are not. And that's, I'll talk about some of that in the talk today. And I should say that I'm an optimist. I was very influenced by Carl Sagan when I was growing up in graduate school, and so Sagan was very optimistic, and I'm also an optimist, and so part of the reason I wrote the book was actually to respond to Ward and Brownlee's book and give some substance to the counter arguments. All right, well, as some of you know, I'm not really an astronomer. I'm in a geosciences department, and so I want to do just a little geoscience here. Let's look at the geologic time scale, and I want to focus on climate. This is the time scale, what we call the Phanerozoic time scale. The Phanerozoic means age of life. This goes back to 543 million years. Of course, we know life goes back much earlier than that, but that's as far back as the fossil record goes. So, the record of Shelley fossils. So for many years, up until the 1930s or 40s, geologists actually thought that life originated 540 million years ago. We won't do all of GSci1 here, but we'll just focus on climate. I want to point out the ice ages, which are labeled here in blue. We're in an ice age right now there are two different definitions for ice ages, I should say. So right now, you don't think of us as being in an ice age. The ice age was 20,000 years ago. There are these glacial to interglacial cycles, and we're in an interglacial cycle within the Pleistocene ice age. The Pleistocene is really only the last 2 to 3 million years. Now, on a long-term scale, time scale, though, you're in an ice age whenever the poles are glaciated. And so the poles have been glaciated, at least the South Pole has been glaciated for about 35 million years ago. That's when Antarctica started to become ice covered. So you should really properly call this the late Cenozoic ice age that we're in right now. The reason I point that out is because that's unusual. The Earth's poles have only been covered in ice about 10% of the time. And the rest of the time, we think that the Earth, it must have been warmer because the poles were, largely ice-free. In fact, you know some of this. If you go back prior to the Cenozoic, you run into the Mesozoic, which was the age of dinosaurs. And you know it was hot. There were dinosaurs running north in North Slope of Alaska, which was still in the same place that it is today. So they were there was no North Polar Cap. There were crocodiles living in Siberia. So the Earth was really warm in the Mesozoic. Prior to that, you run into this, there's about an 80 million year ice age called the Permo-Carboniferous back here. And then prior to that, the Earth was warm most of the time in the in what we call the Paleozoic, except for this ice age right here. There's a very brief one that actually defines a single stage in the geologic record, the Hernantian stage. And so that's an ice age that the sea level dropped by 200 meters, but the ice age lasted less than 1 million years. And so that's a sort of a weird one. These last two, they're arguably caused by changes in CO2 content of Earth's atmosphere. And you heard a little bit already from Deanna and Lisa. It's probably the carbonate silicate cycle that controls that. And so and that in turn is influenced by plate tectonics. So we get these warming and cooling cycles that you see here. And the plate tectonics is actually controlled by something that we call the Wilson cycle. It's the supercontinent cycle. Supercontinents form and disperse on timescales of 400 to 500 million years, and that's probably why it's been getting warm and cold for the last 500 million years. Now, you know, we're more interested here in the evolution of planets on geologic timescales or solar evolution timescales. So here's geologic time now going back from the present all the way to 4.5 billion years ago. The Phanerozoic is this little blue area up at the top, and the rest of the geologic time is what geologists used to call the pre-Cambrian, because it was prior to the Cambrian explosion of life. That's now been subdivided into the Proterozoic Eon and the Archean Eon and the Hadean, which is actually prior to most of the rock record. There are ice ages. Were ice ages during the Precambrian as well. Here, towards the end of the Proterozoic, around 600 or 700 million years ago, there were some very deep glaciations, which Paul Hoffman at Harvard and Joe Kirschfink at Caltech have argued are snowball Earth ice ages, where the oceans freeze over entirely. There's a big debate in the geologic community as to whether that's the case. I think that Paul Hoffman's actually right about that. The oceans did freeze over. Paul thinks that they froze over thickly. It's what we call the hard snowball, where the ice was a kilometer thick or more everywhere. That's tough on biology, because we know that photosynthetic algae sailed right through the snowball Earth. And so there's a variant called, well, there's a model called the slush, which Paul calls the slush ball Earth, where the tropical oceans don't freeze. That doesn't really explain the data very well, I don't think. There's an alternative model called which we call the thin ice model, where the oceans freeze over entirely, but the ice is only about 1 or 2 meters thick in the tropics. And that gives you the characteristics of a snowball Earth, but it allows 10 or 20% of the light to get through. And so the algae do much better in that scenario. There's also warm and cold cycles in the Precambrian. Most of the Proterozoic here, the middle part of the Proterozoic, was warm. The Earth was evidently ice-free for over a billion years. And that actually doesn't fit with these supercontinent cycles that I described. So we think that there may have been other gases that were important, other greenhouse gases that were important. Methane, although it's surprising, because oxygen goes up right here. Nevertheless, methane may have been abundant back then, and so it wasn't just CO2 controlling the climate. Let me point out that there is an ice age right here at when oxygen goes up, and that's actually sort of the part of my story for today. Now, back before the rise of oxygen, oxygen was low. It's possible that reduced gases like methane and or ammonia were more abundant. And then when the oxygen goes up, you lose those greenhouse gases, and you can explain why you get a glaciation at that time. The other thing I'll point out is that there is an evidence for an ice age here at 2.9 billion years in the mid-Archean. The reason that that's important is that there are people, there are geochemists like Paul Knauth at Arizona State University that think that the Archean Earth was really hot. So they geologists try to measure temperatures, paleo temperatures, by looking at oxygen isotope ratios in rocks, carbonates, and cherts. And that's actually how we know most of what we know about the comings and goings of the ice during the Pleistocene. But when you take those data, try to do the same thing for the Archean, you get surface temperatures of about 70 degrees Celsius. And you know, Paul thinks those real. Those are real. I don't think those are real, because then you know, if it has to be 70 degrees Celsius here, and then you go into an ice age, and then it pops back up to 70 degrees Celsius. And in fact, the Earth stays warm according to the oxygen isotope data right up into the Cambrian, and so it's still 55 degrees Celsius or so at the beginning of the Cambrian, which would boil the trilobites. And so the reason, you know, we don't want to get into that argument here, but we don't really understand Earth's climate history that well, because you've got different types of evidence. You know, glacial evidence that tells you it was cold, and oxygen isotopes that seem to tell you that it was warm, and so we don't. These issues are not well resolved. It's like the case with Jupiter. We know something about Jupiter's interior, but we really don't know the entire story about the giant planets in our own solar system either. All right. Well, why is this interesting to astronomers? It's because it's actually remarkable that the Earth's climate is as stable as it is, because the sun has been getting brighter with time. And that's something that this audience probably pretty familiar with. All main sequence stars brighten as they age, although M stars don't brighten very fast. This is an old slide from a paper that I did back in 1988. Shows two things. This is the yellow curve is solar luminosity versus time, which goes with the scale on the right. That's from an old stellar evolution, solar evolution calculation by Douglas Goff, 1981, so 30 years ago. But the standard solar model hasn't changed a lot since then. And it's just the sun is converting hydrogen to helium in its core, so the core becomes denser, it contracts, the fusion reactions go faster, and it heats up. The other two curves are the effective radiating temperature of the Earth, assuming its albedo is constant, and then T sub S is the surface temperature of the Earth, calculated with a one-dimensional radiative convective climate model, in which we made the assumption that the CO2 content of the atmosphere remained the same, but water vapor varies, and just you maintain a constant relative humidity profile. This calculation, by the way, was not new. Carl Sagan and George Mullen published a very similar model in 1972, and so they got basically the same result, that if you make those simplified assumptions, which are not correct, but they're to illustrate the problem, then you find out that the mean surface temperature of the Earth falls below the freezing point prior to about 2 billion years ago. So according to that simplified calculation, the Earth should have been in a perpetual snowball Earth for the first half of its history, but we know it wasn't. There's evidence for liquid water now back to 4.4 billion years. There are no rocks from 4.4 billion years, but there are zircons, these minerals within rocks that actually get recycled even when rocks are taken down into the mantle. And so the cores of zircons have ages as old as 4.4 billion years. And John Valley at University of Wisconsin looks at the oxygen isotopes in the zircons, and they're different from the isotopes in the Earth's mantle, meaning that they have to have been processed by liquid water. There's also evidence for life, pretty good evidence for life, back to about 3.5 billion years ago. And as I just showed you, there's little evidence for glaciation prior, during this time. So we think that the Archean was actually, if anything, warmer than today. And so this problem then is called the faint young sun problem. It's been around for a long time. And the reason I'm talking about it today is because there's actually some new wrinkles on it. And this problem keeps resurfacing every few years. Well, there are different ways to solve the faint young sun problem. You can do it by changing the Earth's albedo, and I'm going to mention a new paper that's coming out tomorrow that they're have an idea that the Earth's albedo was lower back in the past. But the conventional way to solve it, and probably I think the correct way to solve it, is to have higher concentrations of greenhouse gases back in the distant past. Sagan and Mullen, that's what they thought. They suggested methane and ammonia. And methane is a reasonably good greenhouse gas. Ammonia is a really good greenhouse gas, like water vapor, because it absorbs well across the thermal infrared spectrum. But the ammonia hypothesis didn't survive too long because the photochemists came along and argued that ammonia will be photochemically converted to nitrogen and hydrogen, and then the hydrogen escapes. Once you have N, nitrogen is N2, it's N triple bond N, it's pretty stable, and it's very difficult to get back to ammonia. So ammonia only works if you can figure out a way to shield it, which so far people haven't been very good at doing. Now, just to remind you on greenhouse gases are ones that, at least on Earth, varies from planet to planet, depending on how far you are from the sun. But on Earth, they're ones that let most of the visible radiation from the sun in, but they absorb and re-emit the outgoing infrared radiation. You probably know that the two most important ones in Earth's atmosphere are CO2 and water vapor. Methane is a poor third. Water, even though it's a good greenhouse gas, it's different from CO2 and methane because it's right near its condensation temperature. And so if the climate gets colder, water vapor decreases. And if the climate gets warmer, water vapor increases. So it's a feedback effect on climate. And I guess I failed to point out in my faint young sun slide that the white area in the slide represents the greenhouse effect of the atmosphere, which increases with time in this calculation because of the positive feedback of water vapor. It's about, in this calculation, you get about 33 Kelvin of greenhouse effect today and 22 back in the past. You've seen this slide twice now today, so I can go through it quickly. We think that, at least I think, that a large part of the reason why Earth's climate has remained stable has to do with controls on CO2. CO2, of course, is controlled by the carbon cycle, but as you heard from Lisa and Deanna, it's not the organic carbon cycle that is important on long time scales. It's this inorganic carbon cycle, or carbonate silicate cycle. The idea is that the CO2 is removed by weathering of silicates on land. You release calcium and bicarbonate into the oceans, and then organisms use those calcium and bicarbonate to make shells out of calcium carbonate. So there's a Gaian aspect to this. Life is involved in the carbonate silicate cycle. It also speeds up silicate weathering by pumping up the CO2 partial pressure in soils and by creating humic acids that are stronger than carbonic acid. So Gaia is not entirely wrong. I mean, we know that life does influence the climate. This is one of the ways. The carbonate silicate cycle gets completed because most of the carbonate redissolves in the deep ocean, but some of it coats the ocean floor, forming carbonate sediments, and then the seafloor is spreading away from the mid-ocean ridges, and some places it's subducted. The carbonates are carried down and they undergo metamorphism, where the calcium carbonate recombines with silica, which by this time is the mineral quartz, and that releases CO2 back into the atmosphere through volcanism. So think about how that applies to the faint young sun problem. If you were to freeze the ocean over, then you shut off the hydrologic cycle. You might still get a little sublimation from the ice and a little snowfall at higher latitudes, but to make these weathering reactions go, you need liquid water. Direct reactions between gas phase CO2 and rocks are very slow without water. So if you were to freeze over the oceans, you'd shut off the loss process for CO2, but volcanic CO2 would accumulate in the atmosphere. There's good evidence. This is the reason I believe in Snowball Earth, is that if you look at those late Proterozoic glaciations, right above the glacial layers, the diamictites, you find these thick layers of carbonates that are called cap carbonates. And Paul Hoffman, this is really what established Snowball Earth as a theory. He argued that that carbonate represents the CO2 that built up in the atmosphere during the time that the Earth was frozen. And that's also why the slush ball hypothesis fails, in my opinion. All right, so I'll go through the rest of this quickly. This It's what I used to believe was the whole story for the faint young sun. And so if you believed it was just the CO2 feedback, then you can run your climate model and you can say, okay, if solar luminosity is increasing with time, then CO2 would be must have decreased with time in order to counter that. And that, you know, it's not ad hoc because it would do so because of this negative feedback in the carbonate silicate cycle. These are calculations that I actually did more than 20 years ago where time running from 4.5 billion years ago to the present. GA is giga annum. That's how geologists like to write billions of years ago. And that's the CO2 partial pressure in bars. We're at about 300 some ppm of CO2 today, which is 3 × 10⁻⁴ bars. This is the CO2 concentration in PALs, which means times the present atmospheric level. So if you go back to 4.5 billion years ago when the sun was 30% less bright, you need, in this calculation, you need at least a tenth of a bar of CO2 to remain above freezing, and could have had a lot more CO2 than that. You know, Earth has about the same amount of CO2 in carbonates that Venus has in its atmosphere, something like 80 or 100 bars. So it's all in rocks on Earth, but you could conceivably have had a lot of that early on. And as I said, CO2 must go down. These error, what look like error bars, though, those are the glaciations I showed you. And during glaciation, CO2 can't be too low, or you'd go into snowball Earth. Can't be too high, or you wouldn't be in a glaciation. So you can actually bound it. Now, the problem that has come along is that the geologists think that they can measure paleo CO2 levels by geochemical methods. There was a paper 15 years ago now by Rob Rye, Phil Kuo, and Dick Holland at Harvard, where they looked at paleosols. Paleosol means ancient soil. And so they looked, soils usually don't get preserved, but sometimes they do if you cap them with a volcanic rock. And they looked at what they claimed were ancient soils, and they looked for the presence of this mineral, siderite, iron carbonate, which is falling off the slide here. That's a reduced mineral, which you don't find today because of the oxygen in the atmosphere. But they argued that there's iron in soil in rocks, and if there was CO2 in the atmosphere, you should have had siderite. So you can use that to place an upper bound on CO2, which is shown by this line B here. That's log pCO2 in bars. So the red arrow shows where we are today. And that curve A is the CO2 level from the climate model that I just showed you. So the point of this paper was that you paleosols limit CO2 to lower than what you need to solve the faint young sun problem. Well, so then you need other greenhouse gases like methane. So we've worked on methane. Methane, as I mentioned, is a reduced gas. So if oxygen was low on the early Earth, as indicated by this geochemical evidence, which I won't go through, but it's been worked on hard by Dick Holland and others, then you could have methane in the early atmosphere. Methane is a reasonable greenhouse gas, but not a very good one, really. This shows the absorption of different gases as a function of wavelength. CO2 has this big 15 micron band. Methane's in pink here. It has a strong band at about 7.7 microns, which is right on the edge of the atmospheric window region where water and CO2 don't absorb very well. So it's a reasonably good greenhouse gas. If you put methane in your atmosphere, I had a student, Jacob Hochmisra, who worked on this for part, he's still my student, but he did, this was part of his PhD work. We did combinations of methane and CO2. So these are calculations at 2.8 billion years ago. The sun was about 80% as bright as today. PCO2 in bars and different methane levels. You can get about 10 or 12 degrees of warming out of the methane for reasonable assumptions. The problem is that if you get too much methane in the atmosphere, if the methane to CO2 ratio gets greater than about a tenth, you form organic haze like you see in Saturn's moon Titan. And then you get an anti-greenhouse effect because the haze absorbs the sunlight up in the stratosphere. So optimistically, we can get up to this point right here. So we thought we were okay a couple years ago. The new paper, and I'm just got one more slide after this, the new paper is coming out in Nature tomorrow. I probably shouldn't be talking about it because it's embargoed till tomorrow, but I figured there's no reporters that I know of in this audience, and you're all astronomers anyway. So this is a new paper by some geochemists. They place tighter constraints on CO2. They're looking at banded iron formations, which contain both siderite, iron carbonate, and magnetite, which is an oxidized iron mineral. And so then they argue that the CO2 has to be near the phase boundary between siderite and magnetite. I won't belabor their slide because I wrote the News and Views for this, and I made a simpler slide to look at. So here's this is my last slide, solar luminosity relative to today. This is the CO2 partial pressure in bars. These two solid curves are another model calculation like the one I showed you, a more recent one for what you need to solve the climate problem with CO2, if it's CO2 and water that do it. That's the Rye et al. Paleosol limit, which was, you know, we could live with that. There's some other limits here, but this is the new one from Rosing et al. And they claim that CO2 back in the distant past was no more than 3 times higher than today. And that's, you know, if that's right, I'm not entirely convinced that that's correct, but if that's right, then the solution to the Faint-Young-Sun problem has to involve other things. And they suggest an albedo mechanism where cloud albedo is important. So they, as has already been mentioned, the continents are more reflective than the oceans. So if you have smaller continents back in the past, that helps warm you a little. Cloud condensation, you need cloud condensation nuclei, which we already heard about. And so they say that biogenic sulfur gases actually are important in that because they create sulfate. So if there were fewer biogenic, and they're produced by eukaryotic algae that need oxygen. So if you have fewer eukaryotic algae, I mean, you would have none back in the Archean, then you get clouds that have bigger droplets and reduced cloud albedo. So anyway, the bottom line of this is that the Earth's climate history is actually pretty complicated. This story, you know, CO2, as I argued, I think is very important in stabilizing the Earth's climate, but there's other things going on. And so it's an ongoing problem, and we actually need, you know, the astronomers to understand habitable planets. You have to end up talking to geologists so that we, you know, because they're the ones that hopefully will help us understand the Earth. Thank you.
Questions?
Dave Spiegel. Jim, that was a very nice talk. Question. There's another carbon cycle, which is that, another CO2 cycle, which is that at higher temperatures, carbon dioxide dissolves less well in the ocean. So that's a positive feedback. And I'm thinking about if you had a water-covered planet, an ocean world, I wonder if the CO2 cycle that you were talking about would be shut down and you'd only be left with the positive feedback one.
All right, those are both good questions. The solubility of CO2 as a function of temperature really isn't a big deal here because if the ocean is a little warmer, CO2 is less soluble, so that would put more in the atmosphere. But then the carbonate silicate cycle is going to take that out by causing faster weathering. So what the carbonate silicate cycle really does is it controls the combined CO2 content of the atmosphere ocean system. So that part's not really important, but this question of what CO2 would be on an ocean-covered planet, you know, the diagram that I showed you just had the CO2 removal happening on the continents. Well, you know, that's not the only, some CO2 is actually removed on the seafloor as the water circulates through the mid-ocean ridges, especially in the off-axis ridges, you form carbonate veins. And then the carbonate in the veins actually can be subducted more easily than the carbonates on the seafloor. So the stuff on the seafloor gets scraped off and undergoes metamorphism, but the vein carbonates get carried down into the mantle. So there's actually an ongoing debate about the early Earth. If you had no continents, Jim Walker published a paper a long time ago on the which he made exactly the argument that you're hinting at, that, you know, with no continents, you ought to get a lot more CO2 in the atmosphere. But more recently, Kevin Zonley and Norm Sleep have said that, no, the subduction of vein carbonates is actually going to stuff a lot of CO2 into the Earth's mantle, and so they think the early Earth was cold. And so, you know, the theorists are actually, you know, at an impasse here. You need observations to solve it. And as I showed you, we don't actually agree what the temperature of the early Earth was, so we don't know what the right answer is.
Kristen?
Jim, it's a follow-up on this. So if somehow you have an ocean-covered planet and you somehow transition into a snowball, then you have to get the CO2 through the ice sheet. Is that much more difficult to the point that you could remove the thermostat?
Well, so that's also a good question. If you have Paul Hoffman's hard snowball model, the ice is a kilometer thick, and it's probably very difficult to do gas transfer through that. You'll get some, but not that much. The open ocean tide on Earth is about 1 meter, and so that's not enough, as I understand it, to crack kilometer thick ice. If you have the thin ice model, though, the ice is only a meter thick. You've got an open ocean tide of a meter, and so that will crack all over the place, and that'll be much more permeable to CO2. It's sort of analogous to Europa. If you look at Europa, the surface is very cracked. There, the equivalent of the open ocean tide is 30 meters because Europa's going in and out of Jupiter's gravitational field, and you know that is enough to crack the ice on Europa, even though the ice on Europa is pretty thick.
Stan
Peel. Jim, could you elaborate the evidence for the snowball Earth?
So the basic evidence for snowball Earth is that you see glacial deposits at low paleo latitudes. So you have rocks. You can, you know, assuming that the Earth's field is always more or less a dipole. Of course, it reverses polarity every now and then, but this magnetic field is more or less aligned with the spin axis. And as far back as we can track that, you know, the magnetic pole wanders around the geographic pole, but it doesn't go that far away from it. So then you look at the paleomagnetism. This is what Joe Kirschfink does, and if the field lines are more or less parallel to the original bedding plane, then you think that those rocks form near the equator, and you find glacial deposits at low paleo latitudes. The Australian geologists have known this for a long time, ever since the early 1970s, because Australia was sitting at 550 million years ago. Australia was sitting right down on the paleo, on the equator, and it was glaciated from one end to the other. So that's the primary evidence. Then the secondary evidence are these cap carbonates, which I mentioned, which fit right into it. Banded iron formations, which I mentioned but didn't talk about, actually reappear during the snowball Earth, and that indicates that the deep ocean became anoxic, probably because it was cut off from the atmosphere, so you couldn't exchange oxygen very well. So those are the main things.
Mattia?
Mattia Chuk. I have two quick questions. So Dan Schrag had this idea about sulfur early on Mars and maybe on Earth, so as a greenhouse mechanism. And the other one is, what do you think of Peter Ward's theory about changing oxygen abundance on Earth over time during Phanerozoic, and if that could be observable? Like, how would it affect the look of the atmosphere overall?
Yeah, so the SO2 paper, that's a Halevi et al. Paper from two or three years ago, they're worried about early Mars, which early Mars looks like it was warm. We can't seem to make it warm with our CO2 water atmospheres. We keep trying ways to do it, and they suggested SO2. We've got a paper that's, I think, accepted. We've been, you know, going back and forth with referees, which shows that that's very unlikely, because you put the SO2 into the atmosphere, you photolyze it, and you make sulfate particles, even in the absence of oxygen. And the sulfate particles, as you know, Lisa showed you Mount Pinatubo. So when you put a lot of sulfur dioxide into the atmosphere, you make these sulfate particles, which reflect sunlight. They form sulfate aerosols. And so, you know, when we do a coupled photochemical radiative climate calculation, we find that the SO2 cools the climate rather than warming it.
Alan?
Yeah, well, I forgot the second question.
Oh.
Oh, I've actually forgotten what Peter Ward says about oxygen. So I know he thinks that the first eukaryotic organisms were magnetotactic bacteria. This is these huge bacteria that have magnetosomes in it, and this is an idea that Joe Kirschfink likes, but as far as I know, no other biologists like that idea. So I'm not that impressed actually with Peter's ideas on the rise of oxygen.
Alan?
Yeah, Jim, you don't need to worry about the Nature embargo because the paper was released online a couple hours ago, so it must be April 1st in Japan already or something. But the question I have for you is, a lot of this is based on, of course, one-dimensional climate models. How much would doing a real 3D global circulation model change some of these questions?
You know, somebody should do this with a 3D circulation model. It's certainly possible. I think it makes the problem worse. Because see, if you read the new paper, they're working hard with their albedo mechanism to get the temperature up to the freezing point, 0 degrees Celsius. But in a 3D model, if you're that's 15 degrees below the present mean surface temperature. So in a 3D model, the ice caps would expand. You'd get ice albedo feedback, which is positive. So a 3D model is going to make the faint young sun problem tougher. And that's why I think you don't just need to get above freezing. You need to get up to today's temperatures or above. And so I don't think you can do it with albedo feedbacks.
Renu?
Renu Malhotra. Jim, a couple of years ago, or maybe a little more than that, I attempted my student, Dave Minton, and I, we wrote a paper on possibly an astronomical solution to this, and it may have escaped the geoscience audience. So our solution that we attempted was that the sun was a little bit heavier, more massive. We have the solar wind, which is very tiny now. It's 10 to the minus 14 solar masses per year is the mass loss currently. But very early on, it would have been somewhat stronger. And so we looked at how much heavier sun would have compensated for the apparently lower solar luminosity if the sun doesn't lose mass. And it turns out in order to keep the Earth above freezing, with a very simple assumptions about keeping the Earth warm enough, we need only about 2% bigger solar mass. And so then we looked at the astronomical literature on mass loss from sun-like stars. And the evidence there is somewhat, it's ambiguous. It's hard to detect solar winds around, or stellar winds around main sequence or close to main sequence stars. But it's not inconceivable that the sun could have been 1-2% more massive. The difficulty turns out to be to have a slow enough mass loss.
Right.
In other words, for the sun to be losing mass over the 1 to 2 giga-year period where that graph that you showed, where the sun needs to be warmer to keep the Earth warm enough. So it becomes a time scale challenge for the sun to lose enough mass over that amount of mass over a long enough period of time.
Right. So Brian Wood at Colorado has tried to place constraints on solar mass loss by looking at nearby young stars. And you can't measure the stellar winds directly because they're ionized, but there's a shock where they run into the interstellar medium and then you create some neutral hydrogen there. And so they call that the astrosphere. And so they've measured astrospheres around 7 or 8 nearby stars, actually maybe somebody knows this story better than I do because I think there's updates on it. And the story that I know is that you could have big mass loss, but it's all pretty much done within 100 or 200 million years. And maybe I should defer to somebody who knows more.
I don't know that particular story. I'd like to point out there's a record preserved in the core of the sun.
Integrated luminosity, namely in the helium in the core, and we probed that with helioseismology. Off the top of my head, I don't know how tight the constraints are, but in other words, if there was more insulation in the past, then there must be more helium in the core than the standard in the standard models, which assume the sun evolved at essentially constant mass.
Well, you also have to have a mechanism for driving the mass loss. And you know, so the way that this happens, I think, is when the stars are when the sun is rotating very fast early on, then you can get a lot more magnetic activity, and there are sort of magical things that
anything
happen.
Anything is possible, but the point is we can measure the ash. And at the moment, that's why the question is how much the models are fudged. But the agreement between the estimated age of the sun on the solar model and the geologic record is good, you know, to 100 million years or something.
So I think many arguments actually conspire against a solar solution to the faint young sun problem.
Bill?
Thank you. Bill Brookie. Jim, one of the things that people have associated climate change with before is the obliquity of the Earth's pole, and the fact that the obliquity, of course, is a function of the moon and the moon's position, which people believe vary over time. Do you see any effect that might have an effect that's important here?
Well, this is another argument that is made in Ward and Brownlee, which I think is erroneous. And so they've taken Jacques Lascar's result that if you take the present Earth with a 24-hour spin rate and you just magically remove the moon, then Earth's obliquity goes chaotic and it varies from 0 to 85 degrees on timescales of tens of millions of years. But then you have, if the Earth was spinning faster than 12 hours, then the obliquity is stable, even without a moon. So you have to ask, what would the Earth's spin rate be if you didn't have the moon? Well, of course, the moon has been slowing down the Earth's spin rate by tidal drag. And so then you say, what was the Earth's spin rate initially? Well, we think it was 4 to 5 hours. Why was it so fast? Well, that was because of the moon forming impact, which spun it up in the first place. So you tell me, how fast would the Earth be rotating if we didn't have a moon?
Final question, Dave?
So does the Siderite evidence, does the Siderite evidence argue that the Earth never went through a snowball phase when the sun was faint and there wasn't oxygen?
You know, the Siderite evidence, I didn't belabor the geochemistry, but they're looking at the phase boundary between the Rosing et al. Paper between Siderite and magnetite, which is, you know, in the banded iron formations, you find different phases. They're separated spatially from each other, so some of them form more offshore than the others. You have to actually start thinking like a geologist, you know, how do these things form? And so those are two phases that you find there. You also find hematite, though, which is more oxidized than magnetite, and you find iron sulfide minerals. So BIFs are really complicated geochemically. And what I argued in the News and Views article is that, you know, we really need to understand the process by which those things form before you can start pulling out CO2 levels from that. Because there's other arguments. There was a paper in Nature by my colleague Hiroshi Moto, published in 2004, where they used the same BIFs and the same Siderite to argue for a minimum CO2 level of 100 times present. I think the jury's out.
Okay, let's thank all today's speakers again. And don't forget, buses are going to Las Cumbres in a little while, leaving from here, and 9 a.m. tomorrow morning.